Music Made Me, the Alan Schiller story. Adapted in two parts for audio by Tony Staveaker and Alan Harris. Part 1, The Road to Moscow. Schiller, a child prodigy who at the age of 12 was already appearing with major British orchestras, was 18 in 1961 when offered a place at the Moscow Tchaikovsky Conservatoire.
I arrived in Moscow with a dictionary, a Teach Yourself Russian book, and the words «da», «niet», and «zdravstvuyte». It was the 29th of January 1962 at 4:45 in the afternoon. I had been kitted out with a long sheepskin coat, which proved to be most welcome as I stepped off the BOAC Comet into a temperature way below freezing. It also made me easily identifiable, it being the only one in Moscow, and I later became known to locals as the boy in the sheepskin coat. But the road to Moscow had started some 12 years earlier when I had my first piano lessons. That would have been in 1949 when I was 6 years old. My mother and father were both children of Russian Jewish immigrants. Father's parents came from Kaunas in Lithuania, and mother's family were from Lviv in Ukraine. My mother, Frida, was born in London, and my father, Louis, in Leeds. He was a professional violinist, a very fine player, who also played saxophone and clarinet. Although for much of his life he earned his living playing in dance bands and theatre orchestras, his first love was classical music. I always admired his beautiful tone and wonderful intonation, and I'm sure that he would have made a first-rate classical violinist. But because the family were not that well off, he couldn't continue with musical studies beyond the age of 15. My elder sister, Helen, who had been learning violin, wanted to try the piano. And so, on the understanding that I would share lessons with her, my parents bought an upright piano. I'd seen and heard a pianola at a friend's house, and I thought that was wonderful. You made all kinds of music just by pumping the pedals. So I probably thought that playing the piano would be just as easy. Just 1 year later, I was an entrant in the under-12s class, playing the butterfly dance in the Harrogate Musical Festival. The adjudicator, Herbert Howells, wrote, "His little fingers were little hammers. His heart was a lion's. He was without fear, and he laid down the law like a future prime minister." The headmistress of the school that I attended called my mother in and told her that I should be sent to the best teacher they could find. It turned out that a young musician had recently returned from London to Leeds, where she was going to set up a teaching practice. She was a graduate of the Royal Academy of Music, and her name was Fanny Waterman. Later, she was to get together with Marion Harwood to found the Leeds International Piano Competition, which would develop the potential of many fine young pianists. But even in her early teaching days, she was an ambitious young woman, and would-be students had to audition for her. I passed the audition and became one of her pupils. She was a hard taskmaster. Each piece had to be memorised with both hands together and also each hand separately, and you had to be able to start from any bar in the piece. In addition, correct fingering was required on every note, and all these details meant that you were totally secure when you performed the work. From her, I was to learn how to produce pearly scale passage work, wonderful legato and staccato, and to use the pedals to create subtleties in colouring. Unlike teachers of an earlier generation, no hands were smacked for playing wrong notes, but she was fierce verbally, and pupils of all ages were regularly reduced to tears. My first successes as a pupil of Fanny came at the age of 8, again in the Harrogate Music Festival, when I gained second in the under-10s class, first in the under-12s, second in the under-14s, and third in the under-16s. I was now given more ambitious works to learn, and a few days before my 10th birthday, I played the third movement of Haydn's D major concerto with the Yorkshire Symphony Orchestra in Leeds Town Hall. My reward was an inscribed and bound set of J.S. Bach's 48 Preludes and Fugues, which is still one of my prized possessions. At this time, my father was in the Harrogate Municipal Orchestra, playing for the shows in the Royal Hall. The Halley Orchestra also visited the hall each year for a series of concerts, and the manager of the hall, Mr. Baxter, arranged for me to play for Sir John Barbirolli, their principal conductor. Sir John was impressed, and there and then invited me to be the soloist in a charity concert at Leeds Town Hall later that year. I played a complete concerto, Mozart's G major, Kirchel number 453. I am often asked whether I was frightened walking out on stage in front of 1,400 people and with a 70-piece orchestra behind me. The answer is, I don't think it bothered me one bit. Fanny taught me so well that I felt totally secure. I enjoyed it. It was exciting. And I really loved being accompanied by all those grown-up players and being the centre of attention. A second powerful lady now came into my life, Ruth Railton, also later to be made a dame. She came to Leeds to audition youngsters for the National Youth Orchestra of Great Britain, which she had founded just a few years earlier. She first heard me playing when I was 10, and as a result, she invited me to be soloist with the orchestra the following year at the Edinburgh International Festival. At home, I was now able to work on a Steinway upright, kindly loaned to me by Barker's, the main piano dealer in the city. I was fortunate that, although my mother was the taskmaster as far as my practicing was concerned, my parents were not at all pushy. If ever I was loath to practice, my mother only had to threaten withdrawal of piano lessons for me to get down to work again. She was quite justified in insisting on this, as it was a struggle for her to pay for lessons, and she often had to clean for Fanny in lieu of payment. My schoolwork came first in their list of priorities, and my concert appearances were severely rationed. But I did get to play Beethoven's first piano concerto with the Royal Liverpool Philharmonic in Liverpool, and also at the Royal Festival Hall in London under their principal conductor, John Pritchard. When I was 14, I became the youngest soloist at the Henry Wood Promenade concerts at the Royal Albert Hall, and there I played Mozart's A Major Concerto with the National Youth Orchestra, conducted by Hugo Rignold, and this too was a live broadcast. My father felt that after 7 years with the wonderful Fanny Waterman, it was time to move on, to gain new insights from a fresh mind and a new teacher. Fanny was deeply upset. She wanted to carry on. Anyway, shortly before my 16th birthday, I had my last lesson with her. The following months were the hardest, emotionally, in my musical life, as I had become extremely dependent on Fanny's guidance. Having been guided by her through every facet of playing, the shaping of phrases, touch, the spectrum of sound, tonal quality and dynamic levels, I now felt rather lost. The transition from child prodigy to mature artist is one that relatively few succeed in achieving. Suddenly leaving my teacher made it doubly difficult for me. So I was rather fortunate that Ruth Railton should come to my rescue. Ruth agreed with my father that it was a good time for me to move on, and she set the wheels in motion to find me a new teacher and also, crucially, to secure funds for my future musical education. Finding the teacher proved to be relatively easy. Dennis Matthews, one of our leading concert pianists in the 1950s, readily agreed to take me on. Ruth also arranged the funds pretty quickly through her friendship with Sir Malcolm Sargent, one of our most distinguished conductors. He had been made a trustee of a charitable trust newly set up by Hilary, Countess of Munster, to aid young British musicians. In 1959, I became one of the first beneficiaries of the trust, which supported me financially for 6 years, first with Dennis and later in both Moscow and Rome. Its wonderful work goes on to this day. Hilary was the third of a trio of extraordinary women, all lovers of piano music, who had helped me to make my mark in the competitive international concert world. Dennis Matthews and his family lived in Henley-on-Thames, and the Munster Trust arranged for me to live with them while having lessons with him. This was a time when I gave few concerts. I was growing as a musician and steadily building on a strong foundation which I had acquired in Leeds. Dennis was a great musical influence on my life. Perhaps as important was the close friendship we had. Dennis took me to hear Sviatoslav Richter give a series of concerts in London, 3 recitals covering music by Haydn, Prokofiev, Schubert, Schumann, Chopin, and Debussy. These were memorable moments in my young life, thanks to the Munster Trust, which paid for the highly priced tickets. Richter is today acclaimed as one of the greatest pianists of the 20th century. But his first recital of sonatas by Haydn and Prokofiev failed to impress the British critics. Personally, I thought his playing quite sensational. His voicing, the way he separated the strands in the music, was so orchestral. You couldn't work out how he could show you so many different layers of colour within the same musical phrase. Although I knew that Richter was not a teacher, I felt certain after that week of concerts that Moscow was the place where I would like to continue my studies. It was the most marvellous piece of good fortune which led to my being chosen to go to the USSR with the National Youth Orchestra as one of their soloists in September of that same year. Whilst in Moscow, Ruth Railton arranged an audition for me at the Moscow Tchaikovsky Conservatoire. The audition took place in one of the conservatoire rooms, and the works I played for the panel of professors were the Italian Concerto by Bach and part of Schumann's Faschingsschwank aus Wien, Carnival Jest from Vienna. I passed the audition, was offered a place, and then had to wait until the right accommodation was found for me. The Soviet authorities were keen that I be settled in a hotel, which would have given them precious foreign currency, but that was not acceptable to the Munster Trust, who were funding my stay there. Throughout the 4 months of negotiating that followed, Robert Elphick, the Reuters news correspondent in Moscow, liaised between the Soviet Ministry of Culture and Dame Ruth. I am eternally grateful to the late Countess for opening these doors of opportunity for me. And so, at the age of 18, I became the first British student to study at the Tchaikovsky Conservatoire. I was met off the plane in Moscow by Christopher Malaby, assistant cultural attaché at the British Embassy, and he escorted me to the Conservatoire. I remember waiting outside in the car for quite a while until eventually I was ushered in to be welcomed by the principal, Alexander Svezhnikov. He then introduced me to Yuri Kurpiakov, an ex-Bassoon student who had the role of looking after foreign students. Yuri took me over to my new living quarters. The building labelled as House 7 to 10 was an apartment block which mostly housed ordinary Soviet families. It was just a few minutes' walk from the conservatoire. Four of the flats were occupied by foreign music students, and I was put into flat 5 on the first floor. I had arrived during the winter break, and the first few days after my arrival, I was alone in the flat with only Khinh, a non-English-speaking Vietnamese, for company. This was not the happiest of times in my young life, but I don't recall ever wanting to pack it in and go home. During the 2 years I spent there, my flatmates came from Vietnam, Iraq, Bulgaria, Argentina and the Ukraine. When term started, Khinh moved to another apartment, but there were two other Vietnamese in flat 5, Nguyen Trong Bang, who was studying conducting, and Thabon, a violinist. The Vietnamese boys slept in the main room with me and also Vasya Yakovenko, a singer from Ukraine, which was then, of course, a part of the Soviet Union. In the side room, accessed through ours, were Fuad Mashta, an Iraqi flautist, and Ricardo Tsugaro, an Argentinian pianist who was domiciled in Paris. A door led through to the two-bedroom, and each room had an upright piano and circular table. The rest of the flat consisted of a bathroom with a very scary hot water gas geyser, which threatened to explode each time you lit it. And there was a fairly grim toilet. No toilet paper, we used strips of newspaper. Toilet smells were eliminated by burning newspaper after visits. And the very basic kitchen had a small table, storage cupboard and a gas stove. It was used more by the Vietnamese, whose stipends hardly stretched to regular restaurant visits. Days after my arrival, I went into the bathroom to discover quite large fish swimming in the bath. The mystery was solved shortly after, when I heard chopping sounds from the kitchen and received an invitation to share a Viet fish dish. Personally, I did little cooking, due mainly to the lack of interesting ingredients and my own laziness in shopping. A letter home once described a dish that I had made of corned beef, eggs and bread mixed up in a frying pan. It was pretty awful. We were all keen to protect whatever food we'd provided in the kitchen, and it became a standing joke that no one should touch Schiller's marmalade. At that time, you could usually find staple foods such as bread, butter and milk in the shops. There were also two cheeses generally on sale, Golansky, Dutch, and Sovietsky, Soviet, both equally bland and unappetizing. My Russian vocabulary was extremely limited, but the most important word to understand at that time was niet. It appeared regularly on canteen and restaurant menus, in notices in shop windows, and was used in answer to most questions you might ask if wanting help. Flat 5 was a happy place to be, and though we might be irritated with one another from time to time, there were never any major arguments. I was helped tremendously in the early days by two other foreign students who became firm friends. One was an American postgraduate, Malcolm Brown, and the other, Manuel Suarez, a fine Mexican violinist. Malcolm lived in the adjoining flat number 4, and Manuel was housed further from the city centre with his pianist brother Jorge and Manolo Puerto, a Cuban composer. Manolo was reputed to have fought alongside Fidel Castro in the struggle to overthrow the Batista regime. He was usually dressed in battle fatigues and supplied cigars and rum at parties, which made him very popular. Malcolm and Manuel took me shopping and out to eat and generally indoctrinated me into everyday life in Moscow. Our apartment block was entered through a communal entrance in which sat a dejurnaya, an old lady who kept tabs on everyone arriving or leaving. These ladies were also stationed in all hotel lobbies and corridors, and they noted all comings and goings. Their notebooks were regularly checked by the police for any suspicious movements. All phone calls to us were answered by a dejurnaya, who would then give a number of rings to us to let us know who was wanted downstairs. The code was 1 ring for Bang, 2 for Dabon, and 3 for me. For the most part, we lived together most amicably, although one sensed friction between Dabon and Nguyen Chong Bang, between the ardent communist and the Francophile. Bang loved to speak French and always wore a beret, while Dabon was a keen member of the North Vietnamese equivalent of Komsomol, the Young Communist League. He harboured resentment at the colonisation of his country by the French. Practising took place everywhere in the flat. In the corridor, Dabon, the violinist. In the bathroom, Fuad, the flautist. And in the kitchen, Bang, the conductor. In the main room, myself. And in the small room, Ricardo, the other pianist. Somehow we managed to concentrate, but now I wonder how. Tabon was cheerful to an annoying degree and irritated me personally by always anticipating the moment I wanted to get up to use the bathroom in the morning. To compound this, he would start practicing in the hallway shortly after that. His way of working was to make his way through a piece by repeating a very few bars endlessly, over and over again, and always tuning up in between. In the 2 years together, I don't recall his ever playing a piece all the way through. However, he did go on to have a successful career as a concert violinist in Vietnam, while his fellow countryman, Bang, became principal conductor of the Hanoi Symphony Orchestra. On one memorable occasion, the buzzer rang for Tabon, who was practicing in the hallway. He came into our room and put his violin down on the bed and went down to take his call. I was about to sit at the piano to start practicing when Fouad pulled the chair away from me, causing me to stumble. In fun, I took up a boxing stance and we began a mock fight, dancing around the table in the centre of the room. Bang joined in the game as a referee, and everything was great until Fouad backed away from me and sat down on the violin. As we heard the scrunch of splintering wood, he was back on his feet instantly, but the damage was done. The three of us were standing in dreadful silence, surveying the devastation, when in bounced Tabon with his usual exuberance. It was only a moment before he saw his violin and immediately burst into tears. Fouad put a comforting arm round Tabon's shoulder and said, "Never mind, Tabon, we'll get it mended." We took the violin, or rather the pieces of it, to the master violin repairer at the Bolshoi Theatre, and amazingly it was restored to its original condition in about 2 months. Our pockets suffered for that game, and our flat was markedly quieter for quite some time. Fouad, our flautist, was from Baghdad. I had had no previous contact with anyone from the Middle East, and he had known no Jewish people. So when he discovered that I was Jewish, it came as quite a shock to him, as there was a lot of anti-Jewish propaganda in Iraq through caricatures and cartoons. In fact, he was a fine musician and made a career for himself in Baghdad as an orchestral player and teacher. I was so happy to make contact with him by phone recently and to find that he had survived all the upheaval in his country. Ricardo, the pianist from Argentina, I regarded with great respect. He was about 10 years older than I and already had a career behind him. He took me under his wing and was a help with my studies, giving me constructive criticism. He was my favourite dinner companion at restaurants and a wonderful source of intelligent conversation. Bang, the Francophile, was also a few years older and wiser, and helped me to settle into academic student life, which I had not had the chance to experience in England. Apart from his leading role in the Tabon violin affair, he generally spread an aura of calm when he was around the flat. In contrast to the happy, stimulating atmosphere of the musical life we led, we were very aware of the grey, oppressive life being experienced by the population at large. The average Russian was spending at least 2 hours a day seeking out the bare necessities of life while living in crowded conditions and with all the frustrations of an inefficient bureaucracy. It was little wonder that rudeness generally prevailed in the shops and workplaces. There was always the fear of saying or doing something that could land you in trouble. I found out very quickly that in all spheres of life, there was a fear of taking decisions that might lead to recriminations at a later stage. Any dealings with officialdom were inevitably fraught. On the plus side, there was plenty of public transport, and the cost was minimal. 3 kopecks for a tram journey, 4 for the trolleybus, and 5 for the bus. But at times they were packed to the point of bursting. It was one thing to squeeze yourself in, but quite another matter when you wanted to alight. I had to forget all the rules of politeness that I had been taught and use my elbows to force a passage. It wasn't easy for me, at my size, to get through a crowd of stout, heavily overcoated Moscow housewives, and many times I was carried on to the next stop. Throughout my stay, I was aware of how easy it would be for the authorities to find a way of having me thrown out, so I was particularly careful about voicing any criticism of the regime. And even when I returned to England for my first holiday, I found myself looking behind me before telling someone about the shortages and problems in Moscow. I was also chary of an invitation to the Israeli embassy, knowing how carefully embassies were watched, but did accept and enjoyed a wonderful Passover supper there one year, together with embassy staff and other foreign students. Coping with the isolation from home was obviously helped by my having left home at the age of 16 to go to Henley. My main link to family now was through mail and telephone calls. I knew letters from home were certainly opened in the first weeks, as they were always resealed with thick brown Soviet glue. Phone calls had to be booked in advance at the Central Telegraph office on Gorky Street, just 5 minutes' walk from the flat. These were also frustrating, long waits for a connection, interference on the line, or being cut off mid-call. I called home usually at 11 o'clock at night to allow for the 3 hours' time difference with the UK, so it was particularly annoying if there was nobody there to answer. I was probably not at my best during these chats with my parents, and I still have feelings of guilt whenever I think of them. I know we never discussed the political situation, the Cold War or the Cuban Missile Crisis. Music had taken over my life and my imagination. My self-confidence as a piano player when I got to Moscow was pretty low. I had obviously reached a sufficiently high standard to be accepted as a student there, but as I listened to other pianists practicing, both in the flats and in the conservatoire, I felt very much the poor relation. Initially, I was apprehensive lest I might be overheard by the other students. So it was vitally important for me to find a teacher in Russia who was empathetic and understanding of my needs. How fortunate, therefore, that I was told to report to Viktor Karpovich Merzhanov. He wasn't a fully fledged professor at that time, but was classified as assistant professor. As a concert pianist, he had made his mark in 1945 when gaining equal first prize with Richter in the third all-union competition. I met him first in his classroom, number 26. He told me that he spoke only one word of English, and that was gentleman. But he could speak some German. I had an O level in German, so we managed to converse. It turned out that I had met him already, because he had been one of the selection panel at my audition 5 months earlier. Either he had been appointed to take me on, or maybe he had volunteered to tutor me because he thought he could make something of me. I was given the Sonata in A, Opus 101 by Beethoven, and Bach's Chromatic Fantasy and Fugue to prepare for my first lesson in 1 week's time. I worked as hard as I could, but when I arrived at class to play, he took the score of the Beethoven Sonata away from me and said, "Play." How could I have known that he was expecting me to have memorised even a part of the sonata? Or was he throwing me in at the deep end as a test? The lessons were not just one-to-one, but there were others of his students in attendance, either waiting their turn or staying on to listen. So it was more of an ordeal than it might have been. This opening lesson was probably intended to show me that a lot was expected, and it certainly made me aware that I would have to knuckle down if I wanted to satisfy his demands. His classroom had three grand pianos, and the choice was yours as to which one to play. He sat at another and demonstrated. Hand position and body posture were important to him, and he constantly amazed us all with the range of sound he could produce using his whole body weight, but with minimal apparent effort. Although I improved my own technique through his teaching, I didn't have the feeling that he was trying to impose his methods on me. He accepted the positive elements of my abilities and helped them to develop. Merzhanov must have felt that my technique was adequate, because he never tried to take it to pieces and rebuild it. He accepted the fact that I managed to achieve results in my own way. For that I was grateful and relieved. Many string players entering the conservatoire found their technique being stripped back to basics and being made to practice scales for their first year. So I was most fortunate to find myself working with such a fine artist and wonderful human being. He was instrumental in making what could have been a most traumatic period in my young life into an experience that was rewarding and mostly enjoyable. During the course of your lesson, Viktor Karpovich might turn to those sitting round listening and ask for their ideas and criticisms. I recall that on one occasion, when he thought me too kind in my observations, he used his only English word to describe me as too much of a gentleman. Gradually, through Mejanov's sympathetic but firm teaching, my spirits lifted and, with the great respect and love I built up for him, I felt I was gaining confidence. After a month, he shocked me when he told me, "I have used up all my German, now we must speak Russian." But one of my proudest moments came after I played him the whole of the Beethoven Sonata from memory, when he said in English, "That was excellent." He'd obviously learnt the phrase from a colleague.
Alan Schiller, playing the first movement from Beethoven's Piano Sonata in A, Opus 101. Previously, he played the cadenza from Mozart's Piano Concerto in G, Kirchhoff 453, and J.S. Bach's Prelude and Fugue No. 1 in C major from the 48. In part two, shared Sunday afternoons at the piano with a new British ambassador, a not-to-be-repeated invitation to the home of the cellist and conductor Mstislav Rostropovich, and the emotional high of playing in Kaunas, Lithuania, for a hometown crowd.